This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wahib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
the compounded impact that we are seeing, especially on the hospitals and access to healthcare, access to water, in a context that has already been very difficult for many Sudanese to navigate and survive.
That's Human Rights Watch Sudan researcher Mohamed Osman on the escalating war and the indiscriminate attacks by the two warring factions in Sudan. Details coming up. Also, U.S. President Biden issues an executive order for sanctions against those responsible for threatening security and peace in Sudan. And security analysts say it would be disastrous for South Africa to use its army to fight crime. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Heavy fighting was reported today in Sudan's capital, Khartoum, despite the latest ceasefire declarations and appeals from the UN for a truce. Michael Atit reports from Port Sudan, Sudan.
Fighting resumed early morning in Khartoum between Sudan's military and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, despite a one-week truce announced by both parties, which had been expected to commence today. Eyewitnesses say smoke could be seen over the presidential palace in Khartoum and around the other military base in Khartoum North or Bahri due to heavy strikes and bombardment. UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator Martin Griffiths arrived in Sudan late Wednesday to assess the situation. Griffiths called for a genuine ceasefire to allow humanitarian aid workers to reach people affected by the fighting. Sudan's health ministry says more than 500 people have been killed and nearly 5,000 wounded since the military and RSF began hostilities on October the 15th. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Sudan said this week that at least 334,000 people have been internally displaced by the fighting and about 100,000 have fled the country. The office said in a statement that several neighborhoods in Khartoum continue to face water shortages in addition to blockouts and lack of fuel. Michael Atit for VOA News, Port Sudan.
Human Rights Watch HRW is accusing Sudan's two warring generals of using explosive weapons in urban areas, killing civilians, destroying property and damaging critical infrastructure, which has left residents without access to basic necessities. HRW Sudan researcher Mohamed Osman tells VOA's Carol Van Dam the army and the rapid support forces have employed all kinds of explosive weapons in the capital Khartoum and elsewhere in violation of the laws on war since the fighting broke out on April 15th.
Could be fired by mortars, by airplanes, by tanks, by rocket launchers. If they are used, especially in the towns and cities like Khartoum, which is densely populated, it raises the risk of affecting civilians and civilian infrastructures around it, because by the nature of it and by the way it's being used, there are wide range in terms of the impact on the blast. And I think since throughout the last 2 weeks, we have seen the direct and the indirect impact of using these types of weapons, the destructions to residences, to houses, civilian harm, death, injuries. But really, the compounded impact that we are seeing, especially on the hospitals and access to healthcare, access to water, in a context that has already been very difficult for many Sudanese to navigate and survive.
There's such collateral damage as you describe it. What does this say about the two warring generals?
The two warring generals comes to this fighting with a very long, well-documented records of abuses. These two forces have their abuses tracked in conflict areas such as Darfur, Kurdistan, Blue Nile, but also in the context of the crackdown on protesters, whether it's in 2019 or since 2021 coup as well. So they have been manifesting this exact level of abuse in this regard to human life, to international law. But really, I mean, beside the fact that this is their track record, you know, there has no attempt to reform these forces in the last years. But I think the main issue that allows them to continue like having that conduct of hostilities is because they're not fearing any consequences. I mean, the world is still way behind into making sure that these forces and their leaders going to be held accountable at any level.
What about, I don't know if you looked into this, but what about unexploded ordnance from aircraft? Has that been an issue too?
There have definitely been reports. I mean, talking to friends back in Khartoum, pictures you see in social media that, you know, some of them are yet to be verified. But I'm getting a lot of texts and questions about how to deal with these remnants, which is extremely dangerous. I mean, especially for children. It affects also the movement of people who are trying to get groceries, for example, or kids who are playing outside. We saw the long-standing impact of such remnants in Sudan itself after the civil war, but also in other contexts as well. So they do have a long-standing harm. And it's very tricky, of course, for individuals with no training to deal with them.
You talked about the track records of both these two generals in the past and how they've indiscriminately used weapons on civilians. What does HRW want to see happen?
So there are very urgent steps to be taken. I mean, at the front, it should be, the priority should be the focus on civilian protection, the beefing of the humanitarian response that we are yet to see happening, especially in areas that has been seeing a lot of vulnerabilities before, such as Darfur. But more importantly, we want to see the UN Security Council really, really taking lead into making sure, translating that there is no, this is a point of no return for Sudan. Abusive leaders should feel consequences. They should be disrupted and harmed in their capabilities to profit while they're waging this war, holding Sudanese at gunpoint. So this includes targeted sanctions, for instance. This includes as well the expansion of the existing arms embargo to Sudan to make sure these forces have no much further capabilities to continue their war.
That's Mohamed Osman, a researcher on Sudan with Human Rights Watch. He was speaking to VOA's Carol Van Dam from Berlin. U.S. U.S. President Joe Biden issued an executive order today that allows sanctions against individuals or groups responsible for threatening security and peace in Sudan, as well as those who undermine a civilian democratic government or commit human rights abuses. The order appears to be as flexible as possible. It does not name anyone specifically, just lays out broad parameters for punishable actions. Fighting began almost 3 weeks ago, and efforts to forge a lasting ceasefire have been shredded by continued fighting between the army led by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, RSF, headed by General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo. In a statement, Biden called the fighting unconscionable and a betrayal of the Sudanese people's clear demand for civilian government and a transition to democracy. You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. The year's World Press Freedom Index, compiled by Reporters Without Borders and released in conjunction with yesterday's World Press Freedom Day, shows conditions for the most part are getting worse, not better, for journalists around the world. The situation is labeled very serious in 31 countries, difficult in 42, and problematic in 55 countries. Some African nations improved and moved up in the rankings from the previous year, including Togo, Botswana, Gambia, Namibia, South Africa, and Cape Verde. Sadibou Marong, the Sub-Saharan Africa Director for Reporters Without Borders, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that two of the most problematic countries in Africa are Eritrea and Djibouti, where he says authorities crack down on journalists for their election coverage.
It's a country where there is no independent journalists. Only one media outlet is an independent media, and that media outlet is not based in the country. It's based in France, in Paris, and that they have some correspondent out there. And what happens is sometimes what those correspondents, when they're covering demonstration, and so they are mostly arrested. And then we have been working on the case of a journalist in Djibouti arrested for so long time. And most of those arrests are arbitrary arrests. So Djibouti and Eritrea are problematic in our assessment. We have seen, for example, in Africa, the countries where journalists have been killed in 2022 and early 2023. For example, we have this case of Kenya. Kenya has lost 47 places, and the one of the motivation of the, those who have been monitoring the country is the fact that the country, the a foreign journalist, has been killed in there. Arshad Sharif, who is a Pakistani journalist who was just there, who fled his country, and who was there. And he has been killed. The authorities, they said it was a car accident. But according to a lot of assessment of civil society organization, there are doubts on the fact. And let's go from Kenya also to Rwanda. And Rwanda also, John Ntwali, who is a journalist also, very critical to Paul Kagame regime. And then who has been also investigating a lot of information. And who's one of the among journalists who... to dare to give the floor to human rights organizations to criticize the country. He died in a road accident. That's not something we can believe. We have been investigating the case, and Rwanda also falls. And if you go to Cameroon also, it's the same. With Martin Zogo, who is a journalist, very critical to the regime also, very critical to money, to those who are power, financial powers. He's been killed. He's been abducted first, kept for 5 days and then killed. I mean, the practice of journalism is becoming more and more dangerous. Yes, we have also go ahead.
I was going to ask you about Senegal, where you are.
It
fell 31 places on the index. There's a man, a journalist there, who he was just covering a protest, right? And then he got slammed with all these different charges, very serious charges. And he was out there just covering a protest, right?
Yeah, last year. The emergence of journalists with a kind of who most of the time are arrested arbitrarily because in the course of their work, because either they have been covering protests or because they have been also only trying to claim their right in front of security forces and they have been arrested. In Senegal, which falls 31, we have seen the case of Pape Alenia, who is an investigative journalist, who is most of the time very critical to the authorities, and who spent nearly 2 months in jail for, you know, accused of trumped up charge by the authorities. And now also in Senegal, there are two other journalists in prison now. I mean, that means Senegal is starting to become a very dangerous place.
Now, Pepe, he was released finally, right? And thanks in large credit to Reporters Without Borders.
We have mobilized a lot of our supporters and our friends in the civil society, and a lot of African journalists. They have issued an appeal to them. And our Secretary General was in Dakar, and we paid him visit. Yes, and it was a good situation.
That's Sadibou Marong, the Sub-Saharan Africa director for Reporters Without Borders. He was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam from Dakar, Senegal. Press freedom advocacy group Reporters Without Borders, RSF, says African nations recorded some of the biggest drops in their press freedom rankings over the past year. According to an RSF 2023 report released yesterday, practicing journalism has become more difficult overall. In Africa, even though countries like Nigeria have recorded some improvements. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
The RSF 2023 World Press Freedom Index report shows it was difficult for journalists to operate in nearly 40% of the nations in Africa, compared to 33% last year. The report also ranked 46% of the countries as problematic for journalists. Only 10% of the countries showed a satisfactory press freedom ranking. Nigeria moved up 6 places in this year's ranking from 129 last year. But press freedom advocate Oluwatosin Alagbe, a former director at the Center for Journalism, Innovation and Development, or CJID, says there has been no real change.
According to CGID's press attack tracker, if I'm not wrong, since January, we've recorded about 45 attacks against the press in Nigeria. And the elections were an obvious spectacle of the government disregard for the state of the press in Nigeria. So the body language of the government doesn't even speak to wanting to improve it. It keeps saying this. It doesn't speak well. It is definitely not an improvement.
The RSF report said credible journalism is being threatened by a rise in the dissemination of fake content. Last year, Reporters Without Borders said most of Africa's violent attacks and cases of arrest and detention of journalists were in Nigeria, and Nigerian authorities often cite the spread of misinformation and disinformation as the reason for media crackdowns, saying they could undermine peace in the country. Kemi Busari, an editor with Dubawa, a West African independent verification and fact-checking project, agrees the trend has been growing lately.
Purveyors of false information are leveraging on people's sentiments, on people's biases to put out false information. So we get a lot more distaste. So some people have found a market in it just for economic reasons.
Last year, Nigerian authorities drew broad criticism for trying to revoke the licenses of 52 broadcast stations, allegedly over renewal fee problems. The National Broadcasting Commission, NBC, later suspended the move. In late March, the commission fined Lagos-based Channels Television about $11,000 for airing an interview with an opposition party's vice presidential candidate, Yusuf Dati Ahmed. The NBC said Dati Ahmed's commentary on the February presidential election, in which the ruling party's Bola Tinubu emerged as the winner, violated the broadcasting code and could threaten national security. Channels Television did not immediately respond to requests for comment. The rights group Socioeconomic Rights and Accountability Project, or SERAP, sued the NBC, urging it to withdraw the sanctions. Oluwadare is a deputy director at SERAP.
We see the fine itself as an act to stifle some expression. The facts leading up to the sanctions do not justify the sanctions itself. Clearly, this action within the context of events is unwarranted and abuse of the powers of the NBC.
In 2021, Nigerian authorities rejected the RSF's ranking, saying the country was among the freest in the world for journalists. On Wednesday, President Muhammadu Buhari said journalists had, quote, unfettered freedom, end quote, during his administration. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Two of three humanitarian workers abducted in northeast Nigeria have been found safe a week after being taken. The French news agency AFP says their organization, a U.S. nonprofit group called FHI 360, and security sources confirmed they were safe. The aid workers were taken on April 25th from Ngala, Borno State, near the border with Cameroon. It wasn't clear who was responsible for the abduction, but both Islamist extremist groups, which have kidnapped scores of people over the past decade, operate in the region. FHI 360 did not say how they were rescued and said the organization would continue to push for the rescue of the missing worker. The South African government's considering whether to use its army to fight crime, a move security analysts say would be disastrous. Violent crime continues to rise in Africa's most industrialized economy. The latest police statistics show at least 6,000 people are murdered every 3 months in South Africa. That's more fatalities than in war zones. Darren Taylor reports.
Trade unionist Sizwe Pamla is one of many South Africans who support the military being deployed to crime-ridden areas. No one's safe anymore, he says, no matter who you are. And all the ruling African National Congress seems to do is talk.
You can look at what the speeches the last 29 years have said. The reality is that on the ground, people are feeling the effects of administrative failures in the last, 4 years. We have seen a spike in political killings where people are not free to really join their political parties without facing threats to their lives.
He says all over South Africa, every day, people are carjacked, robbed, raped, and beaten up by thugs in their own homes. But director of South Africa's Institute for Security Studies, Yaki Selyer, says the government will make a big mistake if it calls in the army as a quick fix to the crime crisis.
What South Africans seem to believe in is that blue men and women on the street, or in the case of the military, people in fatigues, will somehow resolve the crime situation. It won't. We must fix the police. It is fixing the investigative capacity, the intelligence, the detective capacity that will fix the police. We can't replace the police with the military.
The security analyst says a lot's got to happen before the army and police join to combat crime successfully.
As it is, the army is completely ill-suited to support the police. They can stand at a roadblock, they can do a cordon and search and so on, but we have to train and equip them, and that has not been done. The military has been hugely underfunded and is in a state of neglect and crisis, and that has been the case for probably 2 decades.
Nevertheless, says Selyer, since South Africa became a multiracial democracy in 1994, its army has evolved into quite an effective peacekeeping force. Its troops are currently present in Democratic Republic of Congo and Mozambique. But he points out, taking on criminals in townships and suburbs is very different to fighting rebels in the bush. When soldiers moved into South African townships during the COVID pandemic, many were accused of human rights abuses.
If we systemically decide to use the military, we need to change their doctrine, then train and equip them for the actual jobs that they are going to be required to do going forward, and make that part of their core mandate, not as some kind of an add-on that when there's a crisis that we then call them in and they come in and they are just completely unprepared. They stand there, but they can't really do anything because they have lethal weapons. You don't support the police with lethal weapons, to make one obvious point.
Selyer says soldiers should only confront criminals in extreme circumstances. If they're expected to use heavy caliber automatic rifles to engage in shootouts with gangs, for example, he says lots of citizens are going to be killed in the crossfire. Selyer says the state should instead spend money on resourcing the police. A lot of South Africa's police stations don't even have vehicles and are short of firearms. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The Ethiopian government and rebels from the Oromoya region say a first round of peace talks ended yesterday with no deal to resolve a conflict in which hundreds have been killed and tens of thousands displaced. Reuters News reports that the Tanzanian government said while the talks have been largely constructive, it was not possible to reach an agreement on some issues at this point, adding that the parties agreed to continue to talk. Rebel groups in Oromia, which is home to the country's largest ethnic group, the Oromos, have fought the federal government for decades, accusing it of marginalization and neglect. The talks, mediated by the regional Africa group IGAD, started last week in Zanzibar, a semi-autonomous region of Tanzania. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Shogun Chang, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases?
Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturday.